take a nap. The solemnity of the moment is broken by a frantic banging on the room's steel door. A sobbing Magna Goebbels, wife of propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, demands to see the Führer and begs him not to end his life. Magda and her husband recently moved into the bunker's top floor with their six children. Only 3 days ago, Hitler gave her his own golden party badge as a thank you for her years of fervent support. Now Hitler allows Magda into his sitting room one last time, says a few quiet words of goodbye, then forces her to leave, closing the metal door behind. He does not lock it, however, for the Führer has given strict instructions about what must be done with his body once he is gone. Wait 10 minutes, he orders SS Major Otto Gunche, his military adjutant. Hitler has been carrying his Walther 7.65mm pistol for the past few weeks, and now he chambers around. History does not record the final words between him and Eva Braun. They have known each other for 16 years. She has seen him rise to power, just as she has seen his physical decline. Eva is curled up like a cat on the right side of the sofa. Adolf Hitler takes a seat on the other side, pistol in hand. Eva's own revolver is on a nearby table next to a vase of flowers. She goes first, sliding the cyanide pill out of the small brass lipstick vial and placing it between her teeth. She rests her head on the armrest and bites down on the capsule. To prevent the possibility of failure, Eva is now meant to place her small handgun to her temple and finish the job. This is the policy outlined by the suicide professor, Dr. Werner Haas. But Eva has already made it clear she will not shoot herself. "I want to be a beautiful corpse," she insists to Hitler. The bunker sitting room immediately smells vomit, a scent commonly associated with the hydrocyanic acid. Eva Braun's body loses the ability to absorb oxygen. Her heart and brain, the two organs that need air the most, shut down in an instant. Sadly, it is a death far quicker than suffered by the millions of Jews her new husband sent to the gas chambers. For the Zyklon B gas that was used in the death camps is also a form of hydrocyanic acid. Seconds later, still curled in the fetal position, Eva Braun is dead. The Führer then places his capsule between his teeth. At the same time, he points the business end of the Walther at his right temple. He bites down on the capsule and pulls the Walther's trigger a split second later. His body sags to the side until his torso hangs limp against Eva Braun's. The Führer's pistol drops to the floor next to his foot. Blood pours from his shattered skull, dropping off the couch and forming a great crimson puddle on the floor. 10 minutes pass. Gunche enters. The bodies are wrapped in blankets and taken above ground. Hitler's dying fear was that his corpse might become an exhibit in a Russian museum, so the bodies are doused with 40 gallons of gasoline and incinerated. Adolf Hitler, the man who murdered millions, has claimed his last victim. Chapter 22. Flint Kasern, Bad Taltz, Bavaria, Germany, March 25, 1945, midday. George Patton is smoking a cigar. He has once again been trying to kick the habit, but the boredom of his new job as military governor of Bavaria requires the distraction. With the fighting in Europe over, Patton now works alone in his commandant's office of this former SS officer training school, 30 miles south of Munich. On this beautiful spring afternoon, he can see the Alps rising in the distance. The magnificent Bavarian headquarters is just one of the perks Patton enjoys now that Germany has been defeated. Rather than sleep on an air mattress in the cramped mobile trailer he has called home for much of the last 9 months, the general lives in a manor house built on the shores of a shimmering blue mountain lake. "This is the handsomest villa I have ever seen," he remarked in a letter to his brother-in-law, Frederick Eyre, just yesterday. Patton has a bowling alley, a swimming pool, and two boats at his disposal. "If one has to occupy Germany," he added, "this is a good place to do it from." May in Bavaria should be an idyllic time for Patton, yet he is anxious, longing for just one more battle. The Third Army is still at full strength in May 1945, soon to begin the process of transitioning men and material back to the USA. Patton spends his days lobbying to fight in the Pacific. He is still hopeful of having a chance to fight the Japanese, as he wrote in two letters to well-connected friends in Washington yesterday, knowing that they would pass along the word to others who might arrange such a posting. But a command in the Pacific is now unlikely. His monumental ego and that of the massively self-important Pacific Theater commander General Douglas MacArthur would surely clash. Yet Patton is not one to avoid conflict. He is still fuming over an order from Dwight Eisenhower in the waning days of the war that prevented the Third Army from advancing into Czechoslovakia to assist the people of Prague. Instead of allowing Americans to come to their aid by halting Patton's tanks, Eisenhower made it possible for the Russian army to enter Prague. As in Berlin, the Russians did not come in peace and were soon suppressing the locals in the same horrific manner. Even weeks later, Patton still seethes about the absurdity of Eisenhower's order. He believes Ike to be a fool. Patton has been wary of Russian duplicity as far back as November 1943, when he noted in his diary that it will be just as bad for us to have Russia win the war as it will be for Germany to do so. To be a success and maintain world peace, the U.S. and U.S. alone should destroy Germany and Japan and be ready to stop Russia. Patton has met with Russian generals and officials several times since the war ended. Each time they applied him with alcohol, his Russian counterparts trying to get him drunk, hoping he would embarrass himself. But Patton is on to the game, constantly adding water to his whiskey and drinking the Russians under the table. The Red Army is relentless in its quest to control as much of Europe as possible, with Stalin taking full advantage of Dwight Eisenhower's timidity. The Russians are seizing more land and more people are coming under their occupation. Patton is incensed. "You cannot lay down with a diseased jackal," he recently insisted to a group of journalists. "Neither can we ever do business with the Russians." When Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson visited Third Army, Patton openly lobbied for at least 30% of all American troops to remain in Europe. "Keeping our forces intact, let's keep our boots polished, bayonets sharpened, and present a picture of force and strength to these people. This is the only language they understand and respect. If you fail to do this, then I would like to say to you that we have had a victory over the Germans, but have lost the war." Even Patton's nemesis, British Field Marshal Montgomery, agrees. When accepting the surrender of German soldiers, he ordered his troop to stack the Wehrmacht rifles in such a way that they could be easily redistributed should the Germans and British need to defend themselves against a Russian advance. Yet the Harvard-educated Undersecretary Patterson thinks Patton is delusional. He advises Eisenhower, Army Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall, and President Harry Truman to continue to view the Russians benevolently. In time, of course, Patton's predictions will come true, and the world will have to live with the consequences of American gullibility. The Soviet threat is not the only thing troubling Patton. He personally has undergone a series of strange near-death coincidences. First, there was the attempt a few weeks ago by the Spitfire to shoot down his airplane. The British had loaned many of those airplanes to the Polish Air Force, and it was originally believed that it was a Polish pilot who attacked Patton's L-5. But it turns out the only Polish Spitfire wing in that part of Germany at the time was stationed far to the north, on the Baltic coast. The Spitfire has a combat range of 395 miles, making it impossible for the Polish fighters to make the round-trip flight from their base in Nordhorn to the location where Patton was fired upon, nearly 300 miles south. Records also show that no Polish aircraft went missing, and no Polish pilots were killed on the date of the attack, even though the Spitfire in question had Polish markings. A Russian pilot, however, could have been the culprit. Winston Churchill had been kind enough to give Joseph Stalin's Air Force 1,000 Mark 9 Spitfires to fight the Nazis. The planes were everywhere over the skies of Germany. 2 weeks after the air attack, Patton was riding in the passenger seat of his open-air Jeep when a German peasant's ox cart nearly smashed into his vehicle. A long pole tipped with a sharpened farming blade protruded from the front of the cart. "We were nearly killed," Patton wrote of his near decapitation in his journal. "The pole missed us by inches." Army intelligence agents have warned Patton that his life may be in danger. NKVD, the Russian security force in charge of political assassinations and espionage, is thought to be tracking Patton's movements. Whether it is the Russians or crazed Nazi sympathizers who have visions of assassinating him, Patton has taken no chances. His security detail has been strengthened, and he now carries a loaded revolver with him at all times. As night approaches, Patton takes a break from writing letters in his office near Bad Taltz as General Hobart Hap Gay, Patton's longtime chief of staff, enters through the open door. "Generally," says to Patton, "there's a Russian brigadier out of my office who says he has instructions to speak with you personally." Patton removes the Monte Cristo Especial cigar from the corner of his mouth. "What the hell does the son of a bitch want?" "It's about rivercraft on the Danube," Gay replies vaguely. Bring the bastard in, Patton replies. You and Harkins come with him. Patton depends greatly on the wisdom of both Gay and Colonel Paul Harkins, who have been both at his side for years. In fact, it was Harkins who, 6 months ago at Verdun, nodded to Patton and confirmed the Third Army was poised to quickly wheel north and stave Bastogne. The English-speaking Russian general enters Patton's office, followed closely by Gay and Harkins. The Russian snaps to attention as Patton rises. What follows is a lengthy protest against the behavior of the American army. Many Germans fled the Russians by crossing the Danube River into what is now known as the American Zone. Among them were boatmen, who made their living ferrying people across the river. The Russians feel that these men and their boats rightfully belong to Mother Russia. General Patton, the general concludes, the 4th Russian Guard Army demands that you, General Patton, return these craft to Russian control. Patton does not immediately respond. He calmly places his Cuban cigar in an ashtray, slides open his desk drawer, and removes his Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum revolver. Patton looks hard at the Russian general. He then picks up the revolver and smashes it down hard on the desk. His face goes red. Gay, goddammit! Get this son of a bitch out of here! Who in the hell let him in? Don't let any more Russian bastards into this headquarters. Harkins, alert the 4th and 11th and 65th Divisions for an attack to the east. The Russian general's face instantly goes pale. Terrified, he says nothing as Gay leads him from the room. Harkins, as orders, picks up the telephone and gives the command to commence attacking the Russian lines. The general hurries away from Patton's headquarters. Gay and Harkins quickly return to Patton's office to report on the situation. They fear that Patton may have just started a new war. But the general is all smiles. He reclines in his desk chair once again. How is that? He asks with a grin. Patton doesn't wait for an answer. Sometimes you have to put on an act, and I'm not going to let any Russian marshal, general, or private tell me what I have to do. Harkins call off the alert. That's the last we'll hear from those bastards. But even George Patton knows that is not true. On June 13, it is George Patton who is effectively silenced. He receives news that he has long dreaded. His combat career is over. General Courtney Hodges' emotional meltdown and his ineffective leadership of the American First Army during the early days of the Battle of the Bulge have been forgotten. General Douglas MacArthur has chosen Hodges instead of Patton to join him in the Pacific for the fight against the Japanese. George Patton has fought his last battle. Chapter 23, Schloss Cecilienhof, Potsdam, Germany, July 24th, 1945, late afternoon. President Harry Truman wants a word with Joseph Stalin. As diplomatic negotiations end for the afternoon, he maneuvers around to where Stalin sits. The two men, alongside British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, have spent the day discussing the post-war future of Germany. A small group of advisors from each nation is also seated at the 10-foot-wide circular table in this century-old palace just outside Berlin. The high-ceiling room is stifling, smelling of stale cigarette smoke and 10 degrees too warm, thanks to the summer sun shining in through the unopened windows. The Potsdam Conference, as it will be remembered, is the first time that the new Big Three are meeting since the death of Franklin Roosevelt. Joseph Stalin plays the role of entitled host, behaving as if Potsdam were now a part of Russia. The tablecloth and chairs at the negotiating table are bright Russian red. Outside in the gardens, the Russians have even planted bright red flowers in the shape of the communist star. As with the last meeting between Allied leaders in Yalta, Stalin has every intention of steamrolling his guests into acceding to his demands. The ongoing American policy of accommodating the Soviets, rather than containing their growing power, plays right into his hands. Churchill is bitter. Joseph Stalin has not only taken full control of Eastern Europe, but is widely viewed as a hero by the rest of the continent. There is growing speculation that voters in France, Scandinavia, Italy, and even England will favor communist candidates in their next elections. Indeed, even as Churchill watches Harry Truman casually rise from the table and then pull Stalin aside for a brief chat, the people of Britain are at the polls, selecting a new government. Churchill will fly home tomorrow to hear that he is no longer prime minister. Harry Truman does not have that kind of problem. He is America's leader, at least until 1948. He's a reluctant president, considers the White House a jail, But Truman is also moving quickly to put his own stamp on American politics by replacing FDR's cabinet and trusted advisors with men he considers loyal to him. Truman possesses one presidential trait that Franklin Roosevelt lacked, and that is the poker player's ability to tell when another man is lying to him. FDR's administration was filled with men such as Wild Bill Donovan, who gained access to the president through flattery and self-promotion. Harry Truman has no time for panderers who put their own interests before those of the American people. When one of Roosevelt's most powerful advisors, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau Jr., threatened to resign if he wasn't allowed to attend the Potsdam Conference, Truman immediately called his bluff. Morgenthau stepped down 3 days ago. His plan will not be implemented. Truman is fiercely independent. In his lifetime, he has been a soldier, farmer, bank clerk, railroad worker, owner of a men's clothing store, judge, and senator. He once dreamed of being a concert pianist and still makes time to play. He waited until he was 35 to get married, but his devotion to his wife, Bess, is such that he regularly writes her long letters whenever they are apart. Upon his arrival in Potsdam, the Secret Service overheard an Army officer make the mistake of telling Truman he could arrange anything you would like while you're here, anything in the way of wine and women. An appalled Truman chewed out the officer, telling him that I married my sweetheart, she doesn't run around on me, and I don't run around on her. And I want that understood. Don't ever mention that kind of stuff to me again. This traditional American president who dotes on his wife now grabs the elbow of Stalin, a man whose infidelities and brutality drove his wife to suicide. The two world leaders stand apart from the other attendees at the Potsdam Conference, but remain near the negotiating table. For those who can't hear what the two men are saying, it would appear they're simply making small talk. In fact, what Truman is about to tell Stalin will forever change the relationship between the United States and Russia. Truman, the smooth-talking Missouri horse trader, is determined to send a clear message. America is the true power broker at this meeting. The president looks dapper in his double-breasted suit and his bow tie. Stalin and the Russian contingent are all clad in drab Soviet military uniforms. The Russian dictator is a man just as comfortable with hiding his emotions as Truman. Choosing to leave his own interpreter behind, Truman speaks directly to Stalin, letting the young Russian interpreter, V.N. Pavlov, translate his very important message. Winston Churchill stands 5 feet away, next to his foreign minister, Anthony Eden. Both have already been told the news. They silently watch Stalin to gauge his reaction. Stalin is known to remain expressionless in negotiations so as not to give away his true emotions. But Truman knows there is more than one way to bluff in a poker game. After long experimentation, he tells Stalin in his typically direct way, we have developed a new bomb far more destructive than any known bomb, and we plan to use it very soon unless Japan surrenders. Stalin's face is impassive, pretending not to comprehend the full weight of Truman's words. I am glad to hear it, the Russian responds. I hope you make good use of it against the Japanese. The discussion over, the two men engage in small talk for a few minutes before Truman makes his way back over to the U.S. delegation. Churchill is flabbergasted by Stalin's lack of comprehension and will later write, if he had had the slightest idea of the revolution in world affairs which was in progress, his reactions would have been obvious. Nothing would have been easier for him than to say, thank you so much for telling me about your new bomb. I, of course, have no technical knowledge. May I send my expert in these nuclear sciences to see your expert tomorrow? But his face remained gay and genial. The talk between these two potentates soon came to an end. The British and Americans have been cooperating on the special bomb since 1939. Just 8 days ago, in the vast desert of New Mexico, this new atomic weapon was successfully detonated. The explosion was equal to 20 kilotons of dynamite and sent a bulbous cloud nearly 8 miles into the sky. The sand beneath the blast was instantly turned into a layer of green glass 10 feet deep, and the shock waves could be felt 100 miles away. The man who directed the bomb-making project, a theoretician physicist named Robert Oppenheimer, made one simple remark to others who observed the explosion. It worked. Yet Oppenheimer also realized that this device brought an entirely new form of evil to mankind. I am become death, he thought to himself, the destroyer of worlds. Truman had been waiting for confirmation of the blast results and received them while on his way to Potsdam. The coded message detailing the bomb's success was handed to him upon his arrival. Operated this morning. Diagnosis seems satisfactory and already exceeds expectations, it read. And with those words, Truman instantly had the power to assert American demands at the Potsdam Conference. No fighting force on earth possesses such a weapon, and he can threaten to use it on whoever stands in America's way. Here at Potsdam, Truman uses the bomb as leverage to gain assurances that the Russians will join the war against the Japanese. The president also opposes Russian demands that the German people pay for the rebuilding of post-war Europe, with the bulk of those reparations going directly to the Soviet Union. Yet Stalin is not afraid. Unbeknownst to Truman, he knows all about the atomic bomb thanks to his extensive global intelligence network. He has deliberately prepared for this moment, determined not to give away any hint of emotion that will reveal the depth of Russian espionage in America. It does not matter that America is an ally. The Russians spy on anyone who's a threat, considering no act of intrigue to be off limits. Stalin believes that atomic bombs are meant to frighten those with weak nerves. Besides, his scientists are hard at work on an atomic bomb of their own. In 4 short years, the Russians will detonate a giant fireball. Simply put, Joseph Stalin is determined to rule the world. No American president or American general will stand in his way. The outcome of the Potsdam Conference is harsh. In keeping with an earlier agreement at Yalta, Germany will be divided into occupation zones governed by the Allies. Truman also secures a firm commitment from Stalin to join the war against Japan. But after meeting Stalin in person, Truman realizes that the dictator is not a friend to America, that FDR believed him to be. Thus begins Truman's policy of taking a hard line against the Russians and the start of the Cold War that George Patton has long predicted. The sun shines brightly over Germany as George Patton stands at attention. The fingertips of his right hand are firmly pressed to his polished helmet in salute. Dwight Eisenhower stands to his right, also saluting the American flag as it is raised over Berlin for the first time. President Harry Truman stands to Patton's left with his hand over his heart. Next to him stands General Omar Bradley. Per a 1944 agreement between the Allies, known as the London Protocol, Berlin is now the territory of the 4 occupying powers, the USA, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and France. Each nation governs a portion of the city. Russia still controls the areas of Germany surrounding the city, making Berlin a rubble-filled island. "You, who have not seen it," Patton said of the German capital, "do not know what hell looks like." Patton was invited to Potsdam as a visitor to the conference, and from there, traveled by car with the president and his fellow generals to Berlin for the flag-raising ceremony. He has grown despondent in the past few months, undone by the fact that his fighting days are over. He plays squash, rides horses in the Bavarian countryside to keep himself in shape. He's even tried giving up cigars, but to no avail. By all other appearances, Patton looks fit and healthy, but the reality is he's bored, spending his days attending ceremonies, reviewing troops, saluting the flag, and pinning medals on those whose wartime commendations have finally come through. Without a war to fight, Patton is lost. To make matters even worse, the new president dislikes George Patton. Back in 1918, the two men fought in the Great Battle of Meuse-Argonne, and Patton surely appreciated the precision artillery provided by Truman's Battery D, even though he didn't know Truman personally. A colonel in those waning days of World War I, he outranked Captain Truman. But now the tables are turned. "Don't see how a country can produce such men as Robert E. Lee, John J. Pershing, Eisenhower, and Bradley," Truman will write in his journal, "and at the same time produce Custers, Pattons, and MacArthurs." Truman's scathing opinion of the general is based solely on a first impression. He's not taken the time to get to know Patton, and the two will never engage in a meaningful discussion of any kind. Truman just doesn't like him. The two men are polar opposites. Patton has swagger, Truman is humble. Patton is tall and athletic, a larger-than-life military hero. The diminutive, bespeckled Truman, on the other hand, looks like a bank clerk that he once was. Patton was born into wealth, and then married into even more money. Truman has been handed nothing in his life. Nothing, that is, except the presidency. In Patton, Truman sees a braggart who struts around like a peacock in his showy uniform with the polished helmet and bloused riding pants. Truman dresses simply, avoids putting on airs. He detests Patton's flashy style. Despite the many pressing international obligations on his mind as the flag is being raised over Berlin, Truman takes time to covertly count the number of stars adorning Patton's uniform and is appalled to find them adding up to 28. With the Second World War now at an end, the president has little need for a general who believes it is his birthright to speak his mind, especially when it creates international discord. The official American policy toward the Germans is that anyone previously connected with the Nazi regime is ineligible to help the nation rebuild. The Russians agree. In fact, this is a cornerstone of the Potsdam discussions. But Patton dissents. He speaks fearlessly about the lunacy of denazification, telling the press that it is no more possible for a man to be a civil servant in Germany and not have paid lip service to Nazism than it is for a man to be a postmaster in America and not have paid at least lip service to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party when it is in power. Patton disagrees with official American policy, one disturbing element of which is that former German soldiers be used as forced labor in Russia, France, and the United Kingdom. These men, Patton feels, should be used to rebuild their own country. Germany's hospitals are no longer functional. Its sewer systems don't work. The roads and bridges have been bombed. And there are millions of former POWs and displaced persons who will need shelter and food once winter comes. So with words that put him directly at odds with the policies of his president, Patton tells a reporter that German labor is the solution to rebuilding Germany, whether or not someone was once a Nazi. He says, "My soldiers are fighting men. If I dismiss the sewer cleaners and the clerks, my soldiers will have to take over those jobs. They'd have to run the telephone exchanges, the power facilities, the streetcars. And that's not what soldiers are for." In his own way, Patton is still fighting battles. Even as he quietly begins making plans to leave the military, he wages an ironic war in favor of the German people. "The Germans are the only decent people left in Europe. It's a choice between them and the Russians. I prefer the Germans." The Russians interpret this stance as an attempt to shield former SS members, perhaps to use them against the Russians in a future war. They have lodged a formal complaint with Omar Bradley, suggesting just that, noting that Waffen-SS fighters who surrendered to the Third Army in Czechoslovakia during the month of May have not shown up on the list of individuals turned over to the Russians for repatriation. Soviet spies now fill Bavaria, hunting down these SS men. The Russians win again. On June 13th, while Patton is on tour in America selling war bonds, his headquarters is informed by cable that the Third Army must immediately account for any German forces in its region. At the same time, Army Chief of Staff General Marshall orders that Patton's phones be tapped and even takes the extraordinary measure of requesting a psychoanalyst from the Navy's Medical Corps observe one of the general's press conferences to see if Patton is suffering from a nervous breakdown. Marshall himself likes Patton, but his top commander, Eisenhower, has written to him that Patton is, quote, "mentally unbalanced." Ever since the Knutsford incident in 1944, when Patton inadvertently slighted the Russians while speaking to a group of British women, Ike has come to believe that Patton suffers from seizures and bouts of dementia. This serious charge and Patton's habit of speaking out in favor of the Germans has convinced Marshall to investigate Patton's mental health. The powerful Wild Bill Donovan also loathes George Patton. Donovan and the OSS have been working with the Russians ever since he visited Moscow in December 1943. The American and Russian spy agencies are now exchanging information and helping one another on espionage projects within Germany, including spying on George Patton. In fact, OSS agent Duncan Lee, an Oxford graduate and descendant of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, is assigned to deliver to Donovan the monthly confidential report of the military governor in the U.S. occupation zone of Germany. This includes an OSS accounting of Patton's personal movements and wiretap recordings. Wild Bill Donovan's future is uncertain now that Franklin Roosevelt has died. Harry Truman keeps his distance. With the war over, the OSS may be dissolved. Donovan will do whatever it takes to keep his spy agency intact, including undermining the Truman administration's increasingly hardline stance against the Russians by sharing secrets about Patton. But Donovan himself is being deceived. The spy war in Germany between Russia and the United States is ratcheting up. It is, as American intelligence officer James H. Critchfield will later write, the largest, most concentrated, and intense intelligence warfare in history. However, Donovan does little to stop Russian influence within the OSS. Since the summer of 1944, his security office has made it known to Donovan that 47 OSS agents are either communists or Russian sympathizers. Wild Bill also knows that Joseph Stalin has been planting Russian spies within the OSS since 1942. What Donovan does not know is that Duncan Lee, his executive secretary and the man who knows all his secrets, is a traitor. Lee is working for the Russian spy agency NKVD as a double agent. Among invaluable nuggets of information Lee has provided the Soviets over the course of the war was advance warning of the D-Day landing date and the exact location of the atomic bomb research in Tennessee. That the Russians would use such a prized asset, Lee, to gather information about George Patton speaks volumes about their eagerness to see him silenced. In May 1945, Donovan gained shocking information about Patton, of which the general himself is totally unaware. Stephen Skutbik, a special agent in the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, speaks fluent Ukrainian and is tasked with developing undercover sources of Slavic ethnicity to report to American intelligence. On May 16th, he met with Ukrainian nationalist leader Stepan Bandera, who will one day assist the Americans and British in spying on the Russians. Bandera specifically told Skupik that Soviet high command has been ordered by Marshal Stalin to kill U.S. Army General George Patton. Stalin's reasons are simple. Patton defied Russian authority when he invaded Czechoslovakia back in May during the waning days of the war. But rather than being shocked by Skupik's news, Donovan orders him to arrest Bandera so that he can be returned to the Russians, thereby silencing the man who was warning about an attempt on Patton's life. "I was disappointed with my first visit to OSS," Skupik will later write with a great deal of understatement. But the investigation is not over for Stephen Skupik. A few weeks later, he meets with Professor Roman Smolstocky, an academic and former Ukrainian diplomat who's on the verge of being expelled from Germany and sent back into Russian hands. Smolstocky informs Skupik that the NKVD will soon attempt to kill General Patton. Stalin wants him dead. Finally, in the middle of the summer, Special Agent Skupik interviews yet another Ukrainian, General Pavlo Shandruk, who fought with the Nazis in the waning day of the war and is now desperately trying to avoid being sent to Russia. He offers the United States some vital intelligence that he hopes will allow him to remain in the American zone. "Please tell General Patton to be on guard," Shandruk tells Agent Skupik. "He is at the top of the NKVD list to be killed." Wild Bill Donovan and Special Agent Skupik soon meet again, and once more Skupik tells him of the threats, but Donovan dismisses them, saying they are just a provocation. Back in Berlin, Patton stands at attention on this crisp morning, watching the Stars and Stripes hoisted over the city he once longed to conquer. Today, Patton is harboring a dangerous secret. Though American Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson proclaimed on May 31, 1945, that all Allied POWs had been returned, Patton knows that a top-secret policy instituted by General George Marshall, then tacitly approved by Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, effectively abandons all American and British POWs who fell into Russian hands at the end of the war. The Russians are using them as leverage in negotiations with the Allies to ensure all Soviets who have fled to the West will be returned. Patton believes the man to his left, President Truman, has allowed more than 20,000 American POWs to remain in Russian hands. As a military man, Patton will do whatever it takes to see these men released, even wage war. But he is conflicted, because he understands that Truman's motivations for allowing these Americans to be held hostage is to ensure that the Russians join in the fight against the Japanese, and then once the war is over, join a new organization to be known as the United Nations in order to ensure future world peace. Patton is becoming more and more certain that the only way he can speak freely about these issues is to leave the military. Armed with top-secret knowledge and his usual defiant attitude, George Patton has made himself a target, and he knows it. A few weeks ago, before leaving his daughters in Washington, Patton said something that disturbed them greatly. "Well, I guess this is goodbye. I will not be seeing you again." Patton's daughters were shocked. "It's crazy," they protested. "The war is over." To which Patton mysteriously responded, "My luck has run out." Chapter 24, IG Farben Building, Frankfurt, Germany, September 28th, 1945, 4:30 p.m. The man with 85 days to live is about to be fired. George Patton has been summoned, with prejudice, to meet with his boss, Dwight Eisenhower. The same foul autumn rains that stymied Patton 1 year ago in Metz now make flying impossible. So Patton has driven 7.5 hours to the massive industrial office complex that now serves as Ike's headquarters. Patton spent the journey through the bombed-out ruins of Germany, preparing a plan of attack, thinking of the words he must speak to save his career once again. The ride reminded me of a similar one he will write in his diary tonight, that I took from Knutsford to London, when I was strongly under the impression I was going to be relieved and sent home, if not tried. The IG Farben building rises palatial and scrubbed in the midst of a decimated Frankfurt. Olive drab American Army bulldozers prowl the streets all day long, pushing rubble to the sides of the road. The local Germans eke out a living, as best they can, collecting debris to make fires for cooking and warmth, sleeping each night in whatever shelter they can find. Frankfurt resembles a city, one visitor will write of the destruction, not so much as a pile of bones and smashed skulls, resembles a prized steer. But Ike's headquarters is an island of luxury in this decimation, a beige fortress, where the curving stairwells are made of marble, elaborate fountains bubble soothingly, and senior American officers can enjoy a meal of venison, ice cream, and red wine, all served by German servants. Visitors need a special pass just to get in the door. When they do, they find the hallways filled with clerks and junior officers who spend their days pushing paper and counting down the hours until they can rotate stateside. The more quick-witted Germans label Eisenhower's headquarters G.I. Farben House. The same guard complex was also the site where the cyanide base Zyklon B gas, which was used to exterminate millions in the Nazi death camps, was developed. For that reason, the more cynical residents of the city call the structure the Ghetto of the Pharisees. Fresh-cut roses are delivered each day to Captain K. Summersby and other women serving in the U.S. military offices. Summersby's secretarial desk sits just outside Eisenhower's vast office. She wears red lipstick, and her auburn hair is pinned back to reveal her high forehead. Summersby Brown Women's Army Corps uniform is tailored to accentuate her figure. Despite the relaxed working environment, she keeps her jacket on at all times and her tie firmly knotted. Eisenhower's headquarters is a luxurious space, she will write, adding that several tennis courts could have filled Ike's office. Summersby hears the footfalls of George Patton's trademark riding boots coming down the hallway and snaps to attention as General Patton enters the office for the long-delayed meeting. Soon, she hears Eisenhower raising his voice loud enough to be heard through the thick wooden door. This is not typical behavior for Ike, and Summersby is shocked. The meeting between Eisenhower and Patton borders on the volcanic. The relationship between Summersby and Eisenhower is far more congenial. They have been together for 3 years now and are closer than ever. Summersby could have returned to her home in England, but she does not want to leave Eisenhower. However, in just a month, Ike is slated to return to America, where he will replace General George Marshall as Army Chief of Staff. Summersby wants to go with him. She isn't demanding that Eisenhower leave Mamie, his wife of almost 30 years. She would be content to serve as a member of his staff at the Pentagon. After all this time, as part of what Eisenhower calls his immediate wartime family, she finds the thought of returning home alone to England devastating. Their relationship is an open secret. It was quietly condoned during the time of war, and even now, Summersby stays in a special house reserved for female officers, which Eisenhower visits most nights for supper and a few rubbers of bridge. Such an esteemed presence at the dinner table can hardly be kept under wraps. But now, unbeknownst to Summersby, great effort is being taken to make sure that the relationship comes to an end. Army censors have already doctored the official photograph taken at the German surrender ceremony on May 7. The signing took place in a red brick schoolhouse in Rheims, France. In the original photograph, Summersby stands just behind a grinning Eisenhower, who holds up the two pens used to sign the surrender documents. Ike is making a V for victory with the pens. In the censored version of the photograph, Eisenhower is still all smiles, but K. Summersby's image has vanished. No other person was edited out of the picture. The doctored photograph is just the first sign that the affair is doomed. Ike already knows it. General Marshall has threatened to expose Eisenhower if he requests a divorce. Unbeknownst to Summersby, her name will not be on the list of those approved to travel home with Ike. No other member of his staff will be left behind. General Patton thinks Eisenhower is very nasty and show-offish when K. Summersby is around. But the shouts that Summersby hears coming from Eisenhower's office are hardly for her benefit. Patton tries to appear calm, but he squirms in his seat as the evidence against him is presented. He's made a mess of things with the media, yet again. going on record as stating that being a member of the Nazi Party is no different from being a member of the Republican or Democratic Party. To get things done in Bavaria, after the complete disorganization and disruption of 4 years of war, we had to compromise with the devil a little. We had no alternative but to turn to the people who knew what to do and how to do it, he told a small gathering of press one recent morning in his office, defending his use of former Nazi officials in the rebuilding of Germany. With war at end, the journalists who remain in Europe are hungry for any story they can find. Reporters from the New York Times, Chicago Daily News, and New York Herald Tribune were overheard plotting to get Pat by tripping him up with loaded questions that would lead him to make the same sort of ill-advised comments to the press that he made at Newsford. The Philadelphia Bulletin saw nothing newsworthy in Patton's quote and did not even run the story, and the piece was originally buried on the back pages of the Chicago paper. Yet the New York Times, Stars and Stripes, and the New York Herald Tribune made much of Patton's remarks. Eisenhower was irate when he received word, erupting in what Kay Summersby will later describe as the granddaddy of all tempers. General Patton had made his last and final mistake. Now Patton must explain to Eisenhower how he could have been so careless with his words. After past missteps, Patton appeared contrite in Eisenhower's presence. He humbled himself to save his career. But Patton does not choose to do that now. He's dressed in a simple uniform without his pistols. He believes that supplication will be unnecessary. Some well-chosen flattery and reminders of their long wartime friendship should be enough to get Patton out of this jam with Ike. But the truth is, Patton no longer has a career worth saving. He's restless and bored. His behavior borders on depressive some days, with the best remedy being a hunting expedition or time on horseback. Patton desperately misses the war. He longs to arm the Germans and lead them against the Russians. It is a war that should have begun even before Berlin fell, Patton believes. He's not afraid to stand up to the Russians, as he proved at a September 7th parade in Berlin to celebrate the end of the war against Japan. More than 5,000 American, Russian, French, and British soldiers stood in formation on the bright afternoon under the broad Unter den Linden Boulevard near the partially demolished columns of the landmark Brandenburg Gate. Patton stood on the review stand alongside the Russian general Zhukov, both men squinting in the strong sunlight as the troops marched past in review. It is Zhukov who put the greatest pressure on Dwight Eisenhower to ensure that Patton hand over all German POWs to the Russians, particularly those elite SS units whom the Russians believe Patton is hiding from them. Eisenhower has already aligned himself with Zhukov, slighting Patton, Montgomery, and every other American and British general by stating in June that, quote, the war in Europe has been won, and to no man do the United Nations owe a greater debt than to Marshal Zhukov. The Russian general is used to such supplicant behavior. During the war, he ordered his troops to shoot any of their comrades who ran from the Germans, and any Russian village that was thought to have collaborated with the Nazis was burned to the ground. Zhukov is so feared that other Russian generals have been known to tremble in his presence. Patton does not tremble. He was in full dress uniform, much like comic opera, and covered in medals, Patton later wrote to Beatrice of Zhukov. He is short, rather fat, and has a prehensible chin, like an ape, but good blue eyes. As Russian tanks rolled past the reviewing stand, Patton noticed Zhukov gloating over the new IS-3 model tank. Looking up at his American counterpart, the Russian general delivered a taunt. "My dear General Patton," he crowed, "you see that Soviet tank? Carries a cannon which can throw a shell 7 miles. Patton's face remained impassive, his tone calm and sure. "Indeed. Well, my dear Marshal Zhukov, let me tell you this. If any of my gunners started firing at your people before they had closed to less than 700 yards, I'd have them court-martialed for cowardice." Patton's aide, Major Van Merle Smith, will later state that he had never before seen a Russian commander stunned into silence. Yet in his publicly stated belief that the Russians are America's new enemy and should be treated as such, Patton stands alone. Indeed, American troops are either going home or being sent to the Pacific to fight the Japanese, leaving fewer and fewer GIs to fight the Mongols, as Patton calls the Russians. Not that the Truman administration has any intention of doing such a thing. Among those departing is Sergeant John Mims, Patton's driver for the past 4 years. Two have traveled thousands of miles together, and Mims' caution at the wheel has kept Patton from being injured, despite navigating battlefields and avoiding artillery shells. "You have been the driver of my official car since 1940, Patton writes in the farewell commendation to Mims. "During that time, you have safely driven me in many parts of the world, under all conditions of dust, snow, ice, and mud, of enemy fire and attack by enemy aircraft. At no time during these years of danger and difficulty have you so much as bumped a fender." Another driver will soon be assigned to the general, but Mims can never truly be replaced. And Patton is so upset about his leaving that he originally fought to keep him in Europe. Only when he was reminded that Mims has a young wife at home did Patton relent and sign the travel orders. But even more disturbing to Patton is that all his peers are going home to bigger and better jobs, while Patton spends his days reluctantly getting rid of the Nazi presence in Bavaria. Ike will soon be Army Chief of Staff. General Omar Bradley is already in Washington, heading up the new Veterans Administration. And, of course, General Courtney Hodges is off to fight in the Pacific. It seems there is no place for George Patton in a peacetime army. The only job he really wanted, that of Commandant of the War College at the Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania, has been given away to General Leonard Jarrow, a close friend of Eisenhower's who helped plan and lead the D-Day invasion. As their turbulent meeting stretches on, Dwight Eisenhower finally calms down a bit and gets to the main point. Shockingly, his plan is to take Third Army away from George Patton. With this decision, Eisenhower can effectively terminate the press furor over Patton's remarks and place someone in charge of Third Army who will be less sympathetic to the Nazis. "Your greatest fault is your audacity." The words are meant to sting, but both men know that Patton considers audacity his greatest asset. Then the meeting takes another turn. Instead of simply relieving Patton of active command, Eisenhower suggests instead that Patton assume control of the 15th Army. It is a face-saving solution meant to ensure that Patton does not return to America in disgrace. Yet to a fighting man such as Patton, the notion is absurd. The 15th is a paper army tasked with the job of writing the war's history. But Patton has no choice. As he walks out of Eisenhower's office, he finds the same reporters who published the stories leading to his downfall now waiting in the corridor for news of his fate. Eisenhower tells him nothing. Patton also says nothing. He would normally have stayed and had dinner and drinks with Ike. Instead, Patton rushes to the train station across from the R.G. Farben building to catch a 7 p.m. train back to Bavaria. The humiliation slowly sinks in. Patton's beloved Third Army has been wrenched from his grasp. One of the greatest fighting forces in the history of war will now be commanded by another man. Under Patton's leadership, that spectacular assemblage of men, tanks, and big guns led the liberation of France, rescued Bastogne, crossed the Rhine, and would have freed all of Eastern Europe if Eisenhower had not halted Patton's advance. "I've obeyed orders," Patton tells an aide over dinner on the long nighttime train ride. "I think that I'd like to resign from the army so that I could go home and say what I have to say." But powerful people do not want this to happen. George Patton knows too much, and saying what he knows would be a disaster. Chapter 25, Joseph Stalin's Private Villa, Sochi, Russia, October 17, 1945, afternoon. Joseph Stalin is down, but not out. The 66-year-old Russian dictator is taking a rare vacation at his favorite hideaway. At his direction, the lavish mountain home has been painted forest green, so it is completely camouflaged within a grove of cypress trees. Despite this cloak of invisibility, Stalin is on guard as he strolls alone in the palm-tree-lined courtyard, trademark pipe clenched firmly between his teeth. He is obsessively contemplating his future and that of the Soviet Union. The boss, as Stalin is known, desperately needs time away from Moscow. The fresh air and quiet of this retreat 1,000 miles due south of the Russian capital are more than a mere tonic to the overworked despot. Unbeknownst to the Americans and British, Stalin suffered two minor heart attacks at the Potsdam Conference, which he concealed from the public. Despite the ailments, Stalin was able to continue negotiating the future of Europe. The stress of the war, combined with years of working 16 hours a day while puffing on a pipe filled with strong tobacco, is taking a savage toll on Stalin's body. He's afraid that any sign of weakness might lead to an attempt to oust him from power. Only his personal physician, Vladimir Vinogradov, knows the full extent of his health problems. But even at leisure, Stalin is a workaholic and finds vacationing to be a nuisance. Now, as he takes 2 months away from the Kremlin, spending his days in gardening and long walks, he still receives dozens of reports from Moscow each day. And these reports trouble him deeply. Stalin's absence is causing a furor. TASS, the official Soviet news agency, has simply explained that Comrade Stalin has departed for vacation to rest. But few in Moscow or around the world believe there is not more to it. Foreign diplomats and the international press scurry to learn the truth about what's happening in Sochi as rumors fly. There are rumors that Stalin will soon quit his job to be replaced either by Marshal Zhukov or perhaps by Foreign Affairs Commissar Molotov. Stalin may leave his post, the Chicago Tribune is reporting. The ambitious aspirations of Marshal Zhukov to become a dictator have the full backing of the army, while Molotov is backed by the Communist Party. Stalin considers such rumors as a desecration, not only to his reputation, but of the power to which he clings so dearly. Two men who learned the hard way how ruthlessly Stalin deals with those who attempt to usurp his power were Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky and his son Lev Sedal. Trotsky was once a trusted commissar of foreign affairs, just as Molotov is now. But the bond between Stalin and Trotsky was broken when their ideologies about the true nature of communism began to differ. Eventually, Trotsky was forced to flee Russia, taking up residence in Mexico. There, he openly criticized Stalin, believing that he was safe from the long arm of the NKVD. Trotsky was wrong. In August 1940, NKVD agent Ramon Marcarter attacked Trotsky in his home, plunging the sharp tip of an ice axe deep into the former revolutionary's skull. Miraculously, Trotsky initially survived the blow, only to die one day later in the hospital. Trotsky's assassination mimicked that of his 32-year-old son, Lev, 2 years earlier. At the time of his death, Lev Sedal was on the NKVD execution list because he was arranging an international communist conference in Paris that would celebrate his father's, rather than Stalin's, vision of communism. Sedov suffered an acute attack of what appeared to be appendicitis in late January 1938. His symptoms mysteriously disappeared, then reappeared a few weeks later. Immediately, his best friend, an anthropologist named Mark Zaborowski, informed Russian intelligence that Sedov had checked into a small Paris hospital known as the Clinique Mirabeau. Unbeknownst to Sedov, Zaborowski was an NKVD agent. A few days after emerging from surgery, Sedov was in good spirits. He joked with his wife, Jean, and for several days was thought to be enjoying a normal recovery. But when his wife came to visit him on February 14, 1938, Sedov appeared listless. "You know what they did to me last night?" he asked his wife. Suddenly, Sedov stopped talking, apparently unable to finish his thought. 2 days later, to the horror of his wife, he died. An examination found strange purple bruising on his abdomen. Sedov was autopsied twice, but Parisian medical authorities ruled that he died from natural causes. The NKVD chiefs were relentless in their zeal to develop untraceable poisons. Beginning with Genik Yagoda, his successor, the reprehensible Nikolai Yezov, and then the even more heinous Leventi Beria, the ruthless spymasters pushed Soviet scientists to experiment with deadly toxins. The research was done at the top-secret laboratory known as Chimera, the Chamber, where poisons of all kinds were tested on Russian political prisoners. The goal of the scientists working at the Chamber were to concoct an odorless, tasteless poison that would go undiscovered in case of an autopsy. "We set ourselves a task of developing in the laboratory poisons so they could be consumed using wine, drinks, and food without modifying the taste or color of the food and drink," one Russian official would testify at Yezov's secret trial in 1940. "It was also proposed that we invent fast-acting and slow-acting poisons, so they would have no visible impact on the body, so that the autopsy on someone who had been poisoned would be unable to detect that the person had indeed been poisoned." The chamber came into being during Stalin's reign of terror. Various poisons were used to silence enemies of the state. Now, as he endures his necessary time away from Moscow, Stalin has plenty of enemies in need of silencing. He lives like a monk as he plots the future. After spending each day in the gardens, the boss spends his nights reading hand-carried reports from Moscow. He receives no visitors and communicates with the outside world only through an occasional telephone call. Among the dossiers he receives each day are reports from Beria, apprising him of the findings of many NKVD surveillance teams hidden throughout occupied Europe. Stalin is already making plans to replace Zhukov as deputy minister of defense and to humiliate Molotov before firing him as commissar of foreign affairs. As to relationships with the Western allies, the time away from Moscow is giving Stalin an even greater resolve. It's obvious that in dealing with such partners as the U.S. and Britain, we cannot achieve anything serious if we begin to give in to intimidation or betray uncertainty, he messages his top advisors in Moscow. To get anything from this kind of partner, we must arm ourselves with tenacity and steadfastness. The Dakha in which Joseph Stalin now rests was built in 1934. Since then, he has personally signed the death warrants of 40,000 people. Among them, political rivals, military officials, troublesome intellectuals, and personal enemies. Anyone who dares cross Joseph Stalin soon finds himself dead. All it takes is the stroke of a pen and perhaps a lethal dose of untraceable poison. 2,000 miles northwest of Stalin's Dakha, George Patton is restless. Many thoughts run through his mind now that he is no longer occupied by war. Patton understands that he is a famous person throughout the world and that his future might lie in political activism. He'd rather be outside the tent pissing in than inside the tent pissing out, in his own words. In a way, speaking out about controversial issues would give the general an opportunity to wage rhetorical war. Above all, Patton remains a warrior, but his battlefield may be changing. And that prospect is not lost on his enemies, one of whom is currently resting in South Russia. Another is dealing with the captured Nazis at Nuremberg. Chapter 26, Palace of Justice, Nuremberg, Germany, November 20th, 1945, 10 a.m. The crowd rises to his feet in courtroom 600 as the Nuremberg war crimes trials get underway. 20 of Nazi Germany's most brutal leaders sit in the dock under a bank of hot floodlights so bright that each of the prisoners has been given sunglasses. Behind them, a row of white helmeted American military police stand at crisp attention. The eight judges, two each from the United States, Britain, Russia, and France, take their seats at the front of the room. Proceedings begin with a reading of the 24,000-word document listing the atrocities for which these men are being tried. The murder of 1 million Russians at Leningrad, the death of 780 Catholic priests at Mauthausen concentration camp, the machine gunning of British POWs who were recaptured after their great escape from Stalag Luft III, and much more. The litany of grisly indictments will take 2 full days to recount, and the Nazi prisoners soon grow bored. Some, such as Hitler's former deputy Führer Rudolf Hess, actually fall asleep. Former Luftwaffe commander Hermann Göring wears headphones to listen to an interpreter repeat what is being said. Arrogantly, he smirks as an accounting of his war crimes and tales of the art treasures he looted are read into the official court records. The formerly obese Reich Marshal wears a simple gray uniform that hangs off him. He has lost 70 pounds since being taken prisoner. Göring is eager to speak in his own defense. Across the courtroom, he can see the deputy prosecutor, an American who has interviewed him for weeks. They have come to know each other quite well, so much so that Göring has confided stories about the sex lives of Germany's greatest generals and other salacious gossip to his brand new friend who speaks fluent German. That prosecutor is none other than Wild Bill Donovan, the 62-year-old Major General, Medal of Honor winner, and chief of the OSS. The war may be over, but Donovan still has scores to settle. That is why he is here today. Many of his spies died at the hands of the Nazis, who also murdered countless innocent civilians as revenge for successful OSS operations. Donovan is relentlessly anti-Nazi and began laying the groundwork for these trials as far back as October 1943, when he coaxed President Roosevelt into setting up a post-war apparatus for trying war criminals. It was 2 months later, in the spirit of Allied cooperation, that Donovan flew to Moscow and began forging a relationship between the OSS and the NKVD. But things have gone horribly wrong for Donovan in recent months. He's been undone by sordid and unfounded rumors that he's having an affair with his daughter-in-law, a rumor that most displeased the prudish Harry Truman when it reached the Oval Office. In a separate incident, a 59-page report leveling charges of gross mismanagement and incompetence within the OSS was manufactured by Donovan's rivals and also found its way to President Truman. Now, even as the heat from the courtroom spotlights makes his pale, broad face flush like crimson, Wild Bill is desperately clinging to what little authority he has left. A power struggle with Chief Nuremberg Prosecutor Robert Jackson has not ended in his favor, and the fiery Donovan has decided he will soon leave the trials rather than be a subordinate. Even worse, as of October 1st, his agency is no more. President Truman has shut down the OSS. But Donovan knows that the United States needs a global spy network. So even though he's not technically America's top spy any longer, he still maintains a close relationship